Welcome to the Modern Woodworkers Association, a podcast about woodworking from folk who woodwork. Woodworking is what we do, who we are, and what we like to talk about. So join us as we have a drink, sit around, and talk woodworking.
Hi, and welcome to the 276th episode of the Modern Woodworkers Association podcast. I'm Kyle Barton of K. Barton Tools, and I'm here with my co-hosts, Tiami Plotke of the Penultimate Woodshop and Sean Wisniewski of the Corner Workshop. So, how you doing, guys?
Real good.
Good, good. Well, second episode of Just Us. It's still in the holiday season, so why don't we get around to things that piqued our interest. Sean, I think you have something for us.
Yeah. Were you aware that the Modern Woodworkers Association podcast is available on iHeartRadio?
Oh, wow.
Wow. I think I heard something about that, but
that's fantastic.
Thanks for confirming that, though.
I heard a very smart gentleman in Long Island clicked a button.
And sent an email.
See?
Ooh. See?
But if any one of our listeners that would like to or find it easy to share or mention for someone to find us on iHeartRadio, you now can find us on iHeartRadio.
Fantastic.
Indeed.
Well, I have a few things. All of the Lee Valley persuasion that kind of piqued my interest. And the first one is a low-profile track saw clamp or a guide clamp that they've came out with. So you got your Festool. I think this works with all the major tracks out there, the Festool, the DeWalt, the Makita, whatnot. But it's a little clamp that you can that fits in the grooves on the underside of the track for your track saw, and you can clamp it onto a piece of wood, and it's real low profile. Now, all of them, you know, all the major manufacturers make something similar to this, but they're kind of bigger. This is real small and can slip in and out of tight spaces, which might be an advantage. And it's $30, so $29.50, so for two of them. Which is really reasonable when you compare it to the prices of some of the other clamps that are out there.
Could I throw water on this?
Sure, you can throw all the water you want. I've never used one. It just kind of looked interesting.
They are low profile in that their projection down from the underside of the track is minimal. I'm going to guess it's a couple inches based on looking at the picture.
Yeah, that's what I would.
Having been a track saw user for many, many years, I cannot think of a time when the clamp projected too far down below to be useful. I can think of a time when the clamp did not have enough clamping capacity because what I was trying to clamp it to was too thick. Because it was, right. I was trying to clamp it, you know, to the collapsible workmate table I have or something like that. This would not do that because it seems to only have a capacity of probably clamping to about 3/4 of an inch or an inch, which is as thick as you're going to cut with the track saw. So I understand that, but it means you can't clamp the workpiece to something else with these also. But so that's that limits them a little bit. But what I see as the deal killer.
Yeah, I'm looking at here. It's like 2 3/4 of an inch it'll clamp to. Yeah.
But the deal killer is that it's just a twist knob and a threaded rod. So you're going to be twisting and twisting and twisting and twisting and twisting.
Right.
Which is honestly the same problem with the Festool clamps. The Festool clamps are garbage. and they have a cam in them too. So I realize I'm convoluting.
Well, they have two different kinds. They got
they're both garbage.
No, the other one's not too bad.
Yes, they are. Because you know why? Everything is relative.
Right.
For $26.52 on Amazon, you can get DeWalt's clamps, and they're quick clamps that lock into the track of the track.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah. I've heard a lot of good things about this.
Absolutely fantastic, and they fit in. I believe they fit in everybody's track, but I use them.
I'm sure they would
in my Festool track. I don't have the Festool clamps. I have the DeWalt clamps, and they're easy to use one-handed, and that makes them very practical.
Yeah, that kind of like squeeze cam lock thing is kind of crucial on that, right?
Exactly. It's essentially like an Irwin quick clamp, except
That's what it's about.
The dead end of it, rather than have a clamping head, it's got a little rod that slides into the track. And they do a phenomenal job of clamping, and they're very easy to use, and they're essentially the same price as these ones from Lee Valley. So the ones from Lee Valley just seem, I don't see their purpose.
Well, the only thing, if you need that low profile, but what you're telling me is that you've never seen that to be an issue.
Yeah, because the other thing is that the track has, you know, the grippy tape crap on the bottom of it, and because the DeWalt clamps are so easy to use, I tend to clamp most of the time I use it. But if you're cutting a sheet good, you don't need to clamp. It grips itself pretty darn well.
Yeah. I've rarely had the use for a clamp. You know, you bring up a good point, except in some unique applications where I was cutting, mainly when I was using the MFT to cross cut something, and the piece that I was cross cutting was bigger than the MFT.
Gotcha.
So, yeah.
Yeah, where I tend to need the clamps the most is when the piece I'm cutting is not supported fully, and it's kind of sagging, and the extruded aluminum track sags differently than a piece of, say, MDF, so the clamps make sure they stay together while you're cutting them.
Right. Well, anyway, so moving on. All right, Diami, next up is the Lee Valley Clamp Rack. So this is, once again, I think mentioned on an earlier episode, is Lee Valley. Yeah, it's definitely got a CNC machine or somebody doing some CNC for them with some plywood. And they have a clamp rack. It's one of those racks where you stack your clamps in a row out from the wall. So it's not like parallel to the wall. It actually comes out from the wall. And I think there's a number of different options, but this one seems to be, I did a quick check, and this one seems to be the least expensive. It's only $18.50 and will fit a number of clamps on there, you know, including, you know, all the big, parallel clamps and stuff of that nature. Mm-hmm. So it looks like almost
five.
Yeah, if you got the smaller ones, six. But if you have the bigger ones, looks like about five of those. So, and it looked to be a fairly economical choice if you don't want to build them yourself.
Yeah,
it's
it looks pretty righteous the way it's put together.
Yeah, it's got some metal hardware and stuff like that.
The problem with this
Diami. Rain on Lee Valley's parade.
I'm going to. I'm sorry, because I like Lee Valley. I'm sorry, Vic. But you said it already. If you don't want to make it yourself. Like I have three clamp racks of this style where the clamps fit on it kind of essentially sideways and you stack them in front of each other. And staring at mine hold six parallel clamps in their depth, and I couldn't tell you exactly how deep they are. And I made the three of mine in two different sittings, so they're made slightly differently. But they were very fast to make, very fast. And
yeah, this is, I totally agree with you. I mean, I think this is made strictly for someone that just doesn't want to go through the they got other things they want to do than make clamp racks.
I suppose it's true, but
and if shop quality, if your time in the shop is very limited, it might be something. Yeah, I'd rather just buy this for $18.50 rather than
the problem is that $18.50 for one. That's not bad. If you're going to compare it to the cost of the ones that hold them like with their back against the wall, where they're only a single one deep, they can get very expensive per clamp.
But
the problem I have with this is, maybe it's my problem that I have a lot of parallel clamps, but I would need 10 of these.
Oh my God.
And
you more than me.
I would need 10 of them one clamp deeper than they are. Right. So it becomes prohibitively expensive if you have a decent amount of parallel clamps.
Yes, yeah, for sure. So yeah, if it's one, and let's just round up to $20. Okay, mm-hmm. One for $20, the time and the fact that you have to buy way more material than what's used in those, $20 is probably pretty close to what you're going to need. I would probably need four or five, and that's including F-style clamp. You know, which mm-hmm. you could make them fit. And that's the other thing about making them yourself. Those bars are a little narrower, so you could make them, you can make an F style, and then you can make a parallel like the jet style, which is like a one in some inch bar. It's a fantastic idea. Like, honestly, a decent gift idea.
That's pretty
true. It's very true. The other issue I've got with them is I don't know, because in my case, I've got a 4-foot wall that I have got a horizontal rack that I made on there. And I'm kind of peering over to it right now. And it's a style where there's just like a little jaw for each bar to slide into horizontally.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Real typical. It's like an upside down L style. There's no cantilevers or anything like that. But I have that on a bare stud wall. I don't know how I could attach these to a stud, as they're, the bar themselves of those clamps turned sideways is more than an inch when I've got maximum inch and a half to hold on to.
Yeah.
It's possible. I don't know I don't know if there's center holes or
there are center holes on the mounting plate that goes to the wall.
Oh, I do see that. I do see that.
But, okay. But then here's so the thing is. That. These don't need to be 16 inches apart. They need to be mm-hmm. the head of a parallel clamp apart, which is, what, like 5-6 inches?
True, so true.
You've got all that dead space between them. What you would really want to do is mount a backing board mm-hmm. to a couple of studs mm-hmm. and then fasten these to the backing board, which, again, comes back to you're doing a bunch more extra work. Why not just make one yourself?
Yeah, mm-hmm. no. Yeah, because I could, like, disassemble what I have up there, use the backing board that I currently have, turn L clamps, you know, forward, and stack my clamps differently. I mean, it's just kind of consolidate the way they look, and yeah.
If you want, you'd mentioned F style clamps. An absolute dead simple way to store F style clamps in this mm-hmm. very similar fashion is you get 2 2x4s, and the first one you drill for a 3/4 inch conduit metal. Mm-hmm. Just regular galvanized pipe. It doesn't need to be anything fancy. Cheapest pipe you can get. And you drill holes in it, and you screw that to the second 2x4. So now you can stick the pipes in, and they go in that first inch and a half, and they're stopped by the second one.
Mm-hmm.
And you make that wide enough so it's hitting at least 2 studs, and you screw that into the wall, and you've got the pipes sticking out of it, and you just hang your F-style clamps from the pipes.
Yeah.
I've got four of those pipes over my bandsaw right now, and every time I screw at the top of the bandsaw, I knock them down onto me. But it was very cheap and efficient to make, and it holds a ton of clamps.
Yeah, and as I look over there, right above my clamp storage, the proper clamp storage, I have electrical conduit, 2, maybe 3/4 inch conduits right next to each other. Then I've got 1, 2, 3 C clamps. I think it's called a J style clamp. It's the Bessie with a curved top on it. And then mm-hmm. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 F style clamps that just kind of hang up there. So I'm just using what's like utilitarian in my shop space for that purpose. They're just kind of hanging there, you know, the less used ones, they just kind of hang on conduit. Cause it's for an F style, you don't need much more than, like you're saying, like a piece of pipe, a piece of conduit, just like something round and sturdy, and they can just kind of hang on them. So no, I don't know. I mean, it's a good idea. I've wanted since I made my clamp storage, I wanted to do it differently. The only mm-hmm. problem I have with this style of the cantilever kind of stacked style mm-hmm. is I've got 36 inch, 24 inch, and 12 inch bar clamps. If I need the 36, I've got to slide 5 of them out of the way.
That is true.
Yeah, that is true. Yep.
The solution is buy tons of them so that you have a separate slot for every size. Clearly.
That being said, has Jet done a sale this year, or is anybody selling Jet?
They did it on Black Friday.
I missed it. Okay. All right.
Yeah. You know, I got some jet parallel clamps I'm not happy with.
They're not my favorite. They're not bad, but.
The D's, and it's one of my, been on my to-do list for over a year, and I need to call Jet and see if they'll replace the clamps, because they'll work sometimes, but sometimes they will not tighten up. I mean, they'll get to where they're tight, and then it'll loosen up. So where it's grabbing the actual bar, it's not making enough contact to lock the head in place when you tighten the clamp up. And I've tried everything you can imagine. Make sure, you know, hey, is it clean? It doesn't have any glue on it, you know, all those kind of things. And it depends on, you know, where it is on the bar too. So, but it's not consistent. It just kind of happens. So it's, I don't know. Anyway, not to just disparage jet clamps, there just might be something wrong with these.
No, I've had nothing but success with mine.
And you know what's weird about these is I got these on one of those special deals. Mm-hmm. And you know how jet clamps are red? Yeah. These are actually, these that I'm having problems with are actually maroon.
Mine border on maroon?
No, because I bought these packs. I bought two of these packs. Like 1 year I bought one, and then a couple of years later I bought one. So the first year I bought them, those work fine. And they're actually red. Mm-hmm. And then the ones that I bought second time are maroon, which, you know, would drive someone crazy if they have to have everything that matches. But anyway, but these are the ones I have problems with. You know, it's, I think I got, what, 240 or whatever they come in, and 224s or whatever those links are. And I've had problems with all four of them. So anyway.
I've got the Jets. I've got the old Bessies. I've got the newer Bessies. Yeah. I've got Jorgensen's. And I've got, who's the orange company that makes a bunch of neat stuff?
Jorgensen?
No, I'm blanking on their name. My Jorgensen's are orange also, but this is much, yeah. Bora? Bora Tool? Bora.
Oh, Bora, yeah.
I've got the Bora ones. And the Bora ones are very inexpensive, and I found them to be actually a very nice clamp. Really? They're not perfect, but they're good value. But
yeah.
While the original Bessies, the old style K-bodies, little wooden handle was a pain in the butt to turn. The head was fussy. They were nothing to write home about. At the time, they were all that was out there. They were great. But the second other company started coming out with them, they were eclipsed. But I have to say, I think my favorite ones might be the K-body Revo 2s, the newer K-bodies from Bessie. Right. It's a much nicer handle. It's a better locking mechanism. They're not perfect, but they're a nice clamp.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've looked, and like I said, I need to remedy this situation with Jet. It might be a simple fix. I don't know. Maybe several years ago they just had a bad batch of them or whatnot. Who knows? But anyway, we'll see what happens. But yeah, I might have to go with something like that if I can get any satisfaction there. So, well, with the clamp mess out of the way. let me move on to my next Lee Valley item that piqued my interest. And I may have to bash this one a little bit, but I've never used it. And they came out with a Veritas card scraper burnisher. And this is a little burnisher to turn the hook on your card scraper. Okay. And it's really inexpensive. It's $12.50, and it's a two-handed job. So it's kind of interesting in the way that it works. So the burnisher goes through two little finger holes, you know, from one to the other. So you'd actually use both of your hands to slide along the card scraper.
Does that give you better control than a traditional, like,
That's what I don't know. And that's why I'd have to play with it first.
Okay.
And thinking about it, I thought, hey, that might give you a little bit of control, better control. But then I was thinking about it, well, now you're having to control both of your arms going along the card scraper, so you might actually have less control. So that would be my only caveat without using it. But at $12.50, it's probably a pretty decent scraper. And if that is a problem using it two-handed, I don't see why there's any reason you couldn't actually use it one-handed either. So, but $12.50 is really inexpensive for a scraper or for a burnisher. So, you know, if it's of decent quality and, you know, knowing Veritas, Lee Valley Veritas, it should be.
Do they say, like, what hardness that rod is? Because that's
what I was looking at. They don't. They don't have anything along there. So I would assume it's probably a little piece of carbide in there because, you know, they have a carbide burnisher that's, you know, it's not a two-handed job. It's a one-handed job, and it's around the same price. So I'm assuming that, yeah, it's probably just a little piece of carbide there, which is going to be plenty hard enough to turn a hook on a card scraper.
Well, hopefully they'll have this in their little booth at Fine Woodworking Live, and we can play with it.
I'd like to play with it. Yeah, I have a golly, I forgot what the name of it is. It's a French company that has a...
Are you?
Thing. Yeah. And that's not RU, but it's something like that. But it's a one-handed burnisher that's been made for, I don't know,
4,000
years and years and years and years and years. And it's really good. I really like using that. So I really don't have a need for it. But looking at this, if I was like, you know, I don't know, $10 away from getting that free shipping, I might just add this onto my cart. Yeah,
you know what? There you go.
It's a stocking stuffer. You see, in the one of the pictures, guy's putting it in his pocket.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, and that's one thing I think, you know, whether we poo-poo these or not, at least Lee Valley's coming out with some, you know, some interesting ideas at really competitive pricing.
Absolutely. And while I've enjoyed poo-pooing them, that's not to say that they are not bringing out, you know, very value-based and useful things, because there are a lot of people who, even if it's a minimal investment of time an effort, would still rather just buy a clamp and build something fun rather than a clamp rack. So that's fine.
I bought one of Rockler's clamp racks for $20, those little metal ones.
Mm-hmm.
Because why? I didn't want to spend the time making one. Mm-hmm. That was back when I was working all the time, and it's just like, yeah, it's, you know, more valuable to me to spend $20 to save, you know, an hour in the shop, because, you know, by the time you get down, it's going to cost you an hour's worth of time.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
While I love mine and will defend them to the end of the earth, the reason I made them was not because I was trying to be cost effective or wanted to make a clamp rack. It was because I had existing clamp racks. I had, I don't think they've made them for years, but I had Woodpecker's clamp racks. It was like a folded steel one that held them all like on their back, like Mark's old wall of clamps.
Mm-hmm.
And they just took up too much damn wall space. So my clamps are as tightly compact as I could make them in the shop. They hang over a window. They're up at a corner. It was my attempt to pack as many clamps as I could into as little wall space as possible.
Mm-hmm.
It was really the motivating factor in the way I made my clamp rack. Not that I was trying to be cheap or wanted to make a clamp rack per se. I just had to store all these clamps in a tiny space.
Yeah. And Woodpeckers has a system now where you can do that too. That's a little bit different, but it's kind of pricey though.
I'm sure it is.
Yeah. So, But
I'm excited to see what Lee Valley is doing with their CNC, because they seem to be bringing out cooler and cooler things that all fit together. It's neat.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know if they're doing this themselves. It's going to be interesting to talk to those guys. So are they doing this? Because they come out with a lot of interesting little things you can buy. I don't think you were on one of the episodes when they came out with that little fixture where you can mount your
shoulder plane.
Shoulder plane in, but I mean, I'm going to buy one thing of those.
Yeah, I have that shoulder plane, so I'm almost tempted to buy the fixture. And they also have, don't they have a shooting board that's made this way?
Yeah, they have a shooting board. I haven't looked at that too much.
It's like a cast.
Yeah, I already head have one
that you can set the angle to, but the rest of it's all CNC'd plywood.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah, that looked interesting. I like to play
it does.
With it. Yeah. So. But with that, so what's in the shop? So, Diami, what's in the shop?
Well, what's in my shop is really what's on Sean's bench.
That's not true. What I want to push that back. Diami, what's no longer in your shop?
What's no longer in my shop? I thought it was your turn, Sean.
I mean, I got nothing in my shop, man. I got rocket parts. That's not woodworking.
But how did your fins come out?
They're fine. They're good.
You were hand planing them to get a nice even. Is it a bevel in the front? A chamfer? I think we're calling it a chamfer. Right?
It's like a double. Yeah, whatever. It's a knife point. So you kind of got to get both sides of it. They came out well. I hand planed partially, but then I did a little bit of math.
Okay.
And realized simple math. If you want to get to halfway, you put something the half the thickness, or actually I would say the full thickness to the side of what you want to get at, and you lean on that edge and you start sanding.
Mm-hmm.
And so you create basically a 50% chamfer.
Right.
Of a 45 degree, which I didn't actually want, but it ended up working out fine.
You wanted to be a little steeper?
Yeah. Yes. Acute as the angle looks. Gotcha. Shallow as if you're looking at it, because you don't want it to be blunt. You kind of a knife edge again.
I know you talked about this a couple weeks ago, and when you were talking about it, unfortunately, I missed that recording. When I listened to it, what I was thinking is Lee Valley makes, it's not a plane, but it fits in a shooting board, and it's basically a plane. It's like a cast piece of aluminum that takes sandpaper.
Mm-hmm.
And that struck me as probably the perfect tool for this.
Yeah, is it really, does it have like a handle on it? Like, is it an extruded aluminum thing?
Yeah, I think so. It's extruded aluminum. I'm not 100% sure it has a handle.
It's the form of it, like it has a handle grip on the back end of it.
Yeah, that sounds right.
Fully along the length of it. I've seen photos of that, and yes, absolutely. For my purpose,
shooting sanders is what they're called.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, they're $40. $40, not too bad.
Okay. Well, for my purposes, a block of wood worked great, because that's as much as I needed. But it worked out. It was challenging in the other challenge of it. And if I had more time with it, I would maybe think about it more. But what I was using was a piece of old scrap walnut.
Okay.
Because abused walnut, why not? As that distance to the side of what I, the thickness to the side. Mm-hmm. And slowly, as I was sanding away, because I started at like 80 grit, I was eating away that piece. And so the angle kind of slid a little bit. And so the perfect setup would be some like infinite point where nothing would be abraded as you're moving back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
Because you don't want to eat away that edge, because that's kind of like your defining angle edge. And so there's some way, and I've seen posts of guys have used router tables and table saws and how you hold these things to allow that to happen without interfering with what you're holding. It's very tricky. And in my case, this thing's big enough that the edge that I was working with were like at minimum, like 4 inches long. I mean, it's not this thing is scaled big enough that it's not the worst thing to do. But on smaller scale stuff, if you were trying to do this to some like hobby store thing where the fins are like 2 inches long, you're running the risk of injury, if you get too close to things. And so that everything, that all kind of, it comes along with it. But yeah, it was, It wasn't terribly challenging. There was definitely some touch up after the fact, and then for stability to have this thing travel at Mach, even though it's plywood, I treated that knife edge with CA glue.
Okay, stiffen it up.
To stiffen it, yeah, to harden it, essentially.
Is it a special quality of plywood? Do you have to worry about voids in it as you're shaping
this? It came as a kit, and okay. So it's like, I want to say 3/16 quarter inch. It looks like 3-ply. And so that's funny because as I was chamfering it, you kind of had the glue in between there as a darker color that you could kind of work with as a thickness gauge as you went. But it's fairly free of voids. But I did go in, or I was introduced into the world of, I think it's J.B. Weld. No, it's not J.B. Weld. It is somebody else's glazing and filling compound, which is it's not an epoxy. It's essentially a filler, but it dries in like a minute. But it is so small in its composition that it can fill absolute micron divots.
Wow.
It's really cool.
Can you color it?
I kind of doubt it because it's red to begin with. So what I can do is prime over it.
Okay.
But it was, so I use that actually predominantly on the tube of the rocket. Okay. Which is cardboard. I mean, I'm not trying to make that fancy at all. But cardboard being cardboard, it is wound, right? I mean, that's typical. And so those micro grooves of those windings, to if you want to not worry about them being like a sore on your paint job, you fill those. And so I worked at those. I mean, I'm reading blog posts to tell me about all the stuff, but you can work on those, and with just like a flexible, I have like the Rockler glue spreader, right? So it's got little like silicone fingers on one end, and then just a little bit of a spatula on the other end. That little spatula, and I mean like nothing, and I covered a 5-foot long tube of the the revolutions of that winding, and I was able to fill those little voids and sand it almost so that nothing but those voids were red in this case, which is it was really cool. It was just a neat new material that I got exposed to that I wasn't otherwise knowledgeable about. I also got to use JB Weld, but that's a whole other thing, and I've never had to do that either. But high temp JB Weld is a weird kind of epoxy. It stinks to high heaven. But it's because it's metal. Like, it's legitimately ferrous, I think. But it's to bond metal to other things.
Right.
But it has a completely unique odor.
Odor.
Odor. That's a hard word.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's...
Yeah, I've seen all kinds of posts and stuff about people using JB Weld for things, but I've never had a need for it. So that's kind of interesting, though.
Yeah, yeah, and I
say, or maybe I just didn't realize I had a need for it.
Yeah, I've heard about it plenty, but yeah. It was it's interesting stuff. I did that for the motor retainer. So my motor on this thing is 38 millimeters, which is roughly an inch and a half, if my math is right. But it's an aluminum thing. So you like slide the motor in, it's got a little stop collar on it, and then you thread a thing behind it to hold the motor in. And that whole mount gets JB welded into the wood and cardboard tubes that are used for this.
Does that make it not reusable, or do you have to cannibalize the tube in order to get the mount out?
No. Well, the motor is reusable. The motor is expendable, but the tube itself should be okay.
But you couldn't like take that motor, that mount tube, and put it in a different rocket because it's already epoxied into this one, essentially.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Yeah. So not only the motor retainer, but the centering rings that hold that the engine tube in the middle of the rocket, those are epoxied in three different places with fillets and stuff. So yeah, that's not coming out anytime soon. If it catastrophically fails, I could salvage what's in there. But no, not right now. As it sits, there's nothing coming out.
Well, good, because I suppose you don't really want it to.
I don't. I was talking to a guy about using this, launching this rocket, and for starts, I want to like test it, but it's really kind of strange because this thing weighs almost 5 pounds, and. It's fairly heavy. To put something like that only a few hundred feet up, you've got to act really quick and get it to come down pretty soft. Otherwise, it can fail. Mm-hmm. And so I've got to kind of really do a good lot of thinking on that, and do actually a fair lot of computer simulations to make sure I know what I'm doing.
Well, good luck.
Yeah, that's available. I have a good idea. Like with one particular motor, I should be able to put it up only about 800 feet and go. But the next motor up will probably go about Mach speed and go to about 4,000 feet. Wow. So, yeah.
It goes 4,000 feet up. What's the circumference of it landing in? You know, how big an area do you need?
So you need to get FAA approval to do any of that. And they define, well, really, the property you're on defines what you can do. And the field that my son went to for his level one certification, his flew 2,800 feet. Okay. And it landed about a half mile away. Wow. So draw a circle and say that's about it, depending on the wind and yada, yada, yada.
So do y'all put like any type of tracking device in that, GPS, RFID,
They make them. Okay. I have a small device that I picked up on Black Friday, actually, that it tracks that, but it doesn't report it instantaneously. So I can find out how far it flew after the fact, but I got to find it. The nice bit about this is that it's 4 inches in diameter and it's 5.5 feet tall. So as long as I paint it a bright color, you know, I'll be able to find it even at distance. Hopefully. But they definitely do. I mean, this day and age, this is not something that was available, you know, a decade ago even. But you're getting microscopic little tracking devices, GPS. Locators.
I'm thinking you're just looking for it in the woods.
Yeah, no, and they definitely, and actually the one guy that my son has dealt with, he's got an altimeter that has a built-in screamer on it. And so once you activate it, it's just howling this electronic squeal, and that's purely for finding it. And you can hear it from about 50 yards away, which is enough if you're in a tall grass field to help locate it. You know, that, and then there's way more sophisticated, but like anything, you pay for it. Right. I mean, if you want to drop $100 on another thing to track it, sure. But I've saw those in use. A guy had.
Well, I don't know why you couldn't just use one of your old cell phones.
I mean, I could. My son couldn't because his rocket wasn't big enough. But I could totally. But that would alter the weight.
Yeah, it would. It would. Well, it'd be quite heavy.
I don't think it would alter the weight at all if you would just rub some underwear on it and then get a bloodhound.
There you go. You know what? You're right. You're right. That may be all it takes. But no, like this little altimeter I have, which is really cool because I got it for like $20. It's a Bluetooth, enabled. There's an app on my phone that tracks it. It is smaller than the size of an American quarter, and it weighs like 3 grams.
Wow.
It's amazing. It's and again, 20 years ago, never could have happened, but now, absolutely, it's really kind of cool, like what they can do, and for what, I don't know. I was glad. I'm super, like, it's exciting to get into it. It's kind of a cool little thing, but the high school that got my son into it, that kind of introduced me to the whole thing, they, in previous years, had won NASA awards and gone out to Black Rock, New Mexico, and done all these big rocket launches. But I found out after the fact that it was like, oh, hey, we went Mach 1.7 and we went to 27,000 feet or whatever it was. They were also carrying biological blood samples for atmospheric testing. So there's actually a purpose to it.
Hmm.
You know, it's not just blowing something up into the sky. It's like there's some basis of research to them, which is kind of cool.
Yeah, that is cool.
Yeah, I like it.
Yeah.
Well, let's move on to our main topic, so.
The main topic that relates to what's going on in my shop, which I probably should have mentioned.
Exactly. Yeah. What's going on in your shop?
Well, we don't need to get into that, but what I wanted to talk about was things other than wood. You know, I'm frequently talking about the timber strand.
Mm-hmm.
And I've realized that I've used timber strand, I've used LVL on dyed projects with with clear finishes, traditional wood finishes, not a paint finish. And I've used MDF to big effect on projects where it's going to be painted.
Right.
And I don't know that you could tell, you know, what it is when it's painted. It's just, you know, large and smooth. So I know that lots of people kind of poo-poo the man-made materials. But at least personally, I think they absolutely have a place. And I think they also offer the opportunity for making unique pieces with frankly minimal material investment. And you can, you know, depending on how creative you want to get and what you want to do to the substrate, you could have pieces that look like, you know, nothing else. I'm not one for trying to make these non-wood products look like wood. If you want it to look like wood, just buy wood.
Right.
But I think I found that you can get effects from other things that you can't get with regular wood. And I think that makes them very appealing and just really interesting to play with and to use. And I, for one, don't appreciate why the man-made materials get kind of looked down on compared to natural wood.
Yeah, no, if it weren't for the certain characteristics of man-made materials, moisture absorption, semi-delicate in certain thicknesses and forms. Well, yeah,
you could say the same things about real wood.
Oh, you absolutely could. You absolutely could. I mean, but having I've dealt with MDF, and I have a one of my very, very first projects is a simple like DVD storage rack that I did out of MDF, and I rounded over the corners and I did screw and glue construction but then I sanded it, painted it, and you don't know, it's just a painted thing.
Right.
It doesn't matter what it's made out of at that point. I will say in that space it's heavier than it would have been out of pine, but it's more consistent in its construction. The material is far more consistent. So that's my only thing. Like, if you're dealing with those main materials, and specifically an MDF, and if you go even a little cheaper, like a chipboard, you've really got to think about covering it so it's protected from exposure.
That's definitely true of chipboard.
All faces. Absolutely all faces. I mean, even the steps leading down to my stairs are a particle board tread. My basement steps, they're basement steps that I don't have to be fancy. My cat so much as puked on one and it swells up, you know? That's something you need to be concerned about and protect against if you can. But otherwise, I mean, you know, I'm all for it. I mean, it's a material. Go for it. And, you know, I was geeked when I went into Menards and I found pine plywood.
Okay.
Because usually it's like, oh, it's hardwood plywood. There's this. And this is like decent semi-cabinet grade plywood.
Is it PVC plywood, or is it
what? God, I don't know. It's what it was years ago, but I built my little bench out of it. I've got a simple like cabinet frame and then drawers and top made out of it.
Okay.
And it was all just 3/4 plywood, but I got it for like $14 a sheet. You know, and it was like, wow, this is amazing. And it has voids in it and whatever, and it's good for what I used it for. But you could totally, with that material and decent banding, I wouldn't even say veneer, but banding, you could make kitchen cabinets out of it. No one would be the wiser. You know,
you just could also use some epoxy with thickener to
fill the holes. Yeah, that's for later.
Yeah, I think for me, I guess man made materials, the most I use is probably plywood, of course. Mm-hmm. But I think it solves so many problems, especially if it's a decent quality plywood. And that's primarily wood movement issues.
Yeah.
You don't have to worry about that. One of the things I have on this boring jig I'm coming up with is I have these runners on it. So basically, I got to get 3 pieces of wood coplanar. And, you know, you can do that with regular wood, but keeping them coplanar is, you know,
tricky.
2 weeks from now, it's not going to happen. So, you know, I had to introduce, you know, man-made materials. In this case, you know, Baltic birch plywood to be able to do that and make sure that stays consistent over time. And, I've used, plywood for, you know, door panels and things of that nature. Just because of that, not only do you not have that movement issue, but then you can actually glue it in there and make the whole structure a little bit sounder and more solid. Yeah.
I think it was a recent Shop Talk Live, I think, is the podcast it was on. Mm. If I'm misstating which podcast it was.
Well, what is this podcast you talk of? Shop Talk what?
Shop Talk Live. I don't know. They gave me a sticker.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I might have one.
But they recently were talking about the listener question about a racking workbench. And they were describing all these, you know, different ways to put braces in, essentially. And I have a very cheap workbench that I got used on Craigslist for $100. And it's a commercially made thing. The dog holes were 5/8 of an inch, so I've drilled them out to be 3/4 inch. The top's only about 3/4 inch thick outside of the framing and webbing. So it's far from a great bench. But how it served me a decade now as a serviceable bench because of MDF. Because it did rack, and this is a very utilitarian thing I did, but rather than try to add more braces or diagonals or anything like that, what I did was I took old traditional heavy 3/4 inch MDF and I applied a panel to the back vertically, like to close off the compartment underneath it because it has a shelf underneath it, and then I applied a piece to each of the two sides. And those pieces of MDF are biscuited to the legs and then screwed in and all glued together. And it makes my bench much heavier, which, you know, in this case is something desirable.
Yeah.
And makes it absolutely rock solid in terms of racking and twisting. So that was a case where it was a very, very beneficial to have those things. And then recently I've used it, and I don't know if it's just my supplier or if it's become universally more popular and available that it's lightweight MDF rather than traditional MDF. And lightweight MDF is still heavy, but it is. I couldn't tell you what the real weights are, but it is tangibly lighter. If you know what real MDF weighs, you pick up a sheet of this stuff, you're like, oh, that's heavy, but not nearly as bad.
But awful but, flexible at thin.
Oh, it absolutely can be, but you talk about thin. That was the reason I used MDF, because it was a painted piece that I needed to be roughly 14 inches wide. And because I was matching a Craftsman trim, I needed a 14-inch piece that was a true 4/4 thick.
Mm-hmm.
And I needed a 14-inch piece that was 1/4 inch thick. And I considered doing this out of natural wood. And by the time I bought the natural wood, I would have been spending three times as much as the MDF. And then I would have had to mill it to get it down to a quarter inch. And it was just a whole lot of work that for much less money, I was able to buy a sheet of 1 inch thick MDF and a sheet of quarter inch thick MDF and do exactly what I needed to, very cost effectively. And that's what in this project drove me to the MDF, is that it was available in the thicknesses I needed. And I think that that's something that's often overlooked in these products, is that they have flexibility and cost effectiveness in varying the dimensions that you don't get. I mean, I know you can get, you know, true 1 inch plywood, but the sheet of 1 inch MDF, I don't know, the sheet of 1 inch MDF and the sheet of quarter inch MDF delivered to my house was like $60, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
I could not buy a sheet of paint grade 1 inch thick plywood for that much.
Right.
So mm-hmm. it was a good value that offered the flexibility. It wasn't just a utilitarian product. It actually offered the flexibility to do the design I wanted because of the different sizing and thicknesses that were generally available for it. So I think that's a benefit that a lot of people might not consider. They think MDF, yeah. They think a 4x8 3/4 inch sheet.
No, right. And for sure the math of thicknesses makes easy sense when you're dealing with man-made materials. You're yeah. buying them in increments that are easily, you know, put together. You know, that takes out the guesswork of what is 8/4, what is 4/4, true 4/4 as opposed to actual 4/4. And you know, when I was making my bench top, it was, you know, oh, two layers, it's an inch and a half. It's going to be an inch and a half thick. I know it will be, you know, and if you get quarter and 3/4, it's going to be an inch thick, you know, when you're done with it, you know, so that adds to the simplicity of using that stuff. Again, taking out of the guesswork a little bit.
Right.
Yeah. And I mean, you look at some of the man-made products, especially if you get into like the boating industry, I mean, they got some really far out stuff. I mean, I've seen like, I think they got plywood that's, you know, you can get this stuff like 2 inches thick and it's made up of so many piles. And I think they use special resins and stuff like that, that when you cross cut it, it cross cut does not look like plywood. It looks like, you know, regular wood. And it's really amazing, but the stuff is, you know, it's really good, you know, really weather resistant, doesn't move, but it is actually more expensive than solid wood. So but there's you know around here there's a lot of boat building, so you know, you can kind of go into some of these lumber yards and they'll have certain areas that, you know, are just for the marine industry. And there are some unique products out there that you're not going to find a woodworker using because it's cost prohibitive, but mm-hmm. it looks very, very nice. You know, so I mean, there are some great man-made goods out there and products that, you know, you just don't, you know, just the average woodworker is not going to be exposed to. It's not going to be something that's out in your typical lumber yard or at your, you know, Lowe's or Home Depot. But, you know, with that aside, you know, around here where I am at, my Home Depot actually carries some decent plywood. They're relatively, you know, inexpensive. You know, it's still, you know, $45 to $65 a sheet, but the stuff's actually pretty good. I mean, it's not stuff I'm using in my jigs and stuff. It's not Baltic birch plywood or anything of that nature. But, you know, for building cabinets out of for your shop or something mm-hmm. like that, it's more than adequate with no voids. And it's actually pretty interesting. And, you know, I always have usually a sheet or two of that in my shop.
Hmm.
You know, just for those type of projects, you know, You know, I do a lot of shop furniture, and most of my shop furniture is built out of 2x4s and that kind of plywood.
Yeah, I've never, you know, I've never.
Of course, once you surface 2x4s and stuff like that, they actually, you know, well, we can get the southern yellow pine here, so that's nice.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What is marine grade plywood? What makes that unique? I've never known.
It's mainly, and you know, I may be wrong on this, but it's my understanding, it's mainly the glues that are involved.
Oh, they're just water resistant.
Very high level of water resistance.
Yeah, and then of course you also got the veneers are usually a little bit thicker as far as the outside veneer. So, and you know, you're getting those in, you know, some exotic woods, teaks,
yeah,
and mahoganies, yeah. and you know, stuff like that. So yeah, and so you can get that in regular cabinet grade plywood, but I think the marine grade plywood is mainly the glues involved.
Okay.
Yeah,
makes sense.
Now, when you're working with man-made materials, be they sheet goods or timber strand, yeah, or something like that. Do you guys
now, timber strand is, now that's an interesting question. So is timber strand something that you can pick up readily? I mean, here we can get it, but yeah, it's more of a high end, you know, mainly builder only type lumber yard or something you have to order.
Yeah, it is not. It's not. You're not going down to your hardwood dealer to get it.
Okay.
You're going to a commercial lumber yard for, you know, commercial building. Mm-hmm. So I get it the same place I got my MDF, but it's a commercial yard. I mean, it's a commercial yard. Anybody off the street can go and do it. It's not like wholesale only.
Yeah.
But it is a yard for.
Yeah.
It's not a hardwood dealer. It's a lumber yard.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. When I got my LVL for my bench, I actually had to order that. They shipped it into a quote unquote lumber yard like you're talking about. And I had to pick it up there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But when you're using the materials, do you guys find that you alter your work any? Are you using the same tools and the same methods? Or, you know, are your tools precious and you don't want to run the man-made stuff through it? Or what do you find? Do you find you work any differently based on the wood or wood-like medium?
I will say with hand tools, yes.
You're not hand planing your MDF. What's wrong with you, Sean?
Anything like that. And even like we talked about, like simple plywood, little wings or quarter inch plywood. The glues, as we know, are harder than the wood fibers that they're holding together. That wears down a sharpened edge more. Mm-hmm. Naturally. And so that is a concern. I don't care what you're doing. Your router bits will wear down more if you're constantly routering MDF than as opposed to a pine wood. You know, like it has to be a concern to some degree.
Mm-hmm. Agreed. That interesting question you brought up, because like I said, I am using Baltic birch plywood for these runners on the boring jig. Mm-hmm. And what I've, you know, typical is I have a combination blade on my table saw and I use that for everything. Well, it's not the best thing for plywood. You can get by with it. But, you know, since I'm going to be batching these things out, I've said, you know what, I'm going to have to invest in, you know, a nice plywood blade. So I'm actually doing that, actually getting a dedicated blade to do those type of, you know, cutting of plywood so I can get a nice crisp cut, you know, especially when you're cross cutting that stuff. Mm. You know, cross cutting against the, I guess, face grain veneer, you know, so that you can get a nice clean cut when you're doing that. So, So I'm actually going to invest in some tooling to make sure I got the right tools for the job. But yeah, I agree with Sean that, you know, your typical woodworking tools are going to dull much faster using the man-made materials versus the, you know, most normal, you know, solid wood.
Mm-hmm.
Do you guys ever let the man-made material stand out as a design element, or is it always for either utilitarian project where it doesn't really matter, or mm-hmm. something that's a hidden component of a more formal piece?
Yes to both of those last things.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, utilitarian, I don't care. But yeah, if it's something like I'm using it as a panel and a door, the edges are going to be hidden.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Or the little entertainment, the green entertainment console that I built. I think you saw that.
Yeah.
You know, I'm in there. I'm supporting this amp that weighs about 120 pounds in this thing. So I had to, you know, I said, hey, you know, I got to make sure that that shelf that thing sits on, the bottom shelf, is very secure. So it's out of plywood, but I did go ahead and veneer that with mahogany. So,
well, la di da, Mr. Frenchman.
Exactly. So, yeah, when it's in a fine piece, yeah, I haven't, you know, exposed the plies. But, you know, if you're doing a nice Baltic birch, you know, where everything's tight with no voids, you know, it can look nice.
I think it really can. I don't remember what it was. I think it was a bookshelf, like a wall unit. But years ago, Tom made something for one of his friends. It was all Baltic birch, and his friend wouldn't let him edge band it. I believe it was a bookshelf.
Could be.
Yeah.
It has a certain aesthetic, and if you are open to that, sure. But something like Baltic birch has a little more appeal than MDF because it's so bland. You know, in it is consistent in what it is. It is 100% consistent. It doesn't offer much visual appeal in that way that maybe
I'll give you that. But I will argue that it's not 100% consistent because the faces of the panels are unbelievably smooth and essentially closed grain, and the edge is not.
Yeah. Is that because of a finishing technique on them that they
assume that's because they're pressed when they're made? I don't know that they're pressed. It's some sort of a manufacturing issue, but I don't know exactly how they're manufactured.
Right. Makes sense.
But just as a small tip, if you're going to paint them, those edges, whether they're a factory edge or a cut edge that you make, you can take an application of either wood putty or even spackle, and putty or spackle that edge, and then come back and sand it. And if you do that a couple times, it'll completely disappear. If you do it just once, it still reduces the visual appearance of that edge dramatically after the piece has been painted, because that rougher edge will never take paint the same way the really smooth face does. As many times as you repaint it, it's always going to look a little bit different.
For sure.
So I think that was my rant.
Well, a question. Have y'all ever used some of the more, I don't know, these were popular a few years ago in building jigs and things like that with the man-made materials like plywood they use for like sign making or for like concrete forms or anything like that?
Have y'all like the plywood with the phenolic coating on it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Have y'all used that for anything?
I have not.
I want to say I've had a sheet of it for something. I don't know what. I'll come back to it in like 2 weeks and know what I was thinking.
I know it was popular a few years ago for people making jigs and hell, this is the greatest stuff for doing this and this. And I looked into getting some of that.
It's
but
expensive.
It was very expensive and it was hard to get, so I never did. But I haven't seen it been mentioned in probably at least 3-4 years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I want to say I bought a sheet and did something with it, but for the life of me, I cannot remember what that was. So I might not have. I might just be wishing I had. So no, I know exactly what you're talking about. I know it was very popular a little while ago. It had a lot of mind share for like jigs and things like that. But the other thing that it kind of brought to mind is the ultra high molecular weight plastic for like runners and sliding parts.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that you can really put that in the same category as like MDF or timber strand or something. It's not a man-made material per se, I mean, it is a man-made material, but it's not something you're going to use in place of wood. It's
right.
No, I guess you are using it in place of wood, but for a very different reason. I've always preferred that for like miter slot runners. When I make a sled for the table saw, it's my preferred thing for the miter slots. It's pretty neat stuff that in the right application can be very beneficial and mean that you don't have to wax something every time you use it or something like that where you need parts to slide.
Yeah, right, in that case, though, that's a material that is only beneficial for its lack of friction. I don't know that you'd use that as a piece of furniture.
No, I wouldn't think so, especially because it's floppy. It's not a particularly stiff plastic.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Unless you were having some, I mean, I can think of all kinds of weird things you could have with sliding components in a piece of furniture. You might need a piece of that just to, just to, you know, smooth a particular function out or something like that where it slides past something. But yeah, now I haven't used that stuff myself for runners. I only got a couple of table saw sleds. One of them has, you know, white oak runners, typical. Another one has that micro jig runner that they came out with, which is some sort of phenolic plastic. No, I haven't used that. But, you know, I got a couple of cutting boards of that stuff in the kitchen. So I might need that because I definitely need to make a new table saw sled.
Okay.
So that's up next on my things to do around the shop.
Ooh, there you go.
My existing sled's fine. I just need to one. I got this quarter inch flat top blade that I've had for years and I use it all the time. And I keep saying I need to make a sled for that blade and I never have. And I'm starting to get one of my maybe upcoming jigs, it might be imperative that I come up with a sled so I can easily cross cut stuff for that. So with that, what are our fortnightly beer choices? Sean, what are you drinking?
So I fall back to a favorite of mine, which is a Dogfish Head Sea Quench Ale. It's a Saison Sour. It's just lovely, crisp, sessionable. I don't know how you can go wrong with it.
Mm-hmm.
It's good. How about you, Kyle? What do you got?
Well, I'm drinking another Christmas ale, and this one's from St. Arnold's Brewing Company, and I think this is another one I've mentioned before, but it's a nice Christmas ale. It's nice and Christmassy.
Those are the best kinds of Christmas ales.
Yeah. Exactly. We're big fans of this season of the Christmas ales. So, Diami, what are you drinking?
I was going to ask Kyle first. Do you pour that with a sugar rim on the glass that you're drinking it out of?
Oh, my God.
It's a dark cinnamon sugar.
Mm-hmm. Good man. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm.
I was figured as much.
Recently at our office Christmas party at an Irish pub, and I had a Leaf Raker, which is a local IPA.
Mm-hmm. And
it was a loud, crowded bar because in the room we had reserved, they only had bottled beer and it was crappy. So I went to the bar to get a reasonably good beer, and I could not for the life of me hear what the guy was saying. I just kind of yes and yes, and just wanted my drink, and I got the cinnamon on the rim of an IPA, and it was
God,
terrible.
That's where you like you do the first sip, and then you just make sure to sip out of the same spot so there's no more sugar.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, oh, that's what I said yes to. I didn't want that. That's gross.
Yeah. Ugh. I get it. It's fitting on some.
Yeah,
but it's not
that time of year, but it's not the right beer for it.
No,
right? No, not an IPA. Oof. Anyway, Diami, what do you got?
Well, I have 6 points Shatter. It is a good. It's a double IPA. Yeah, it's a double IPA. It's a
Shatter.
Huh. Yeah, it's. It's 25 IBU. It's not particularly bitter. It's 8.7%, so it's strong enough. Not crazy strong, but strong.
Mm-hmm.
It would be an excellent double IPA if not for the false promises of the can.
Which says
it is an extra dank IPA, or an extra dank double IPA. And I would venture to say it's not dank at all.
Now, I've had resin, which is another
resin
one
is a dank IPA.
That's a double dank IPA. Yeah.
This is not dank. This is smooth, which is good in its own right. But when I think of a dank IPA, it's got a little bit more kick to it. It's got a touch of metallicness to it. Resin is a very good dank IPA. A lot of the stuff out of Vermont is they do dank very well. Dank requires high IBUs as part of the mix, but it's more than just that. Six Points lately has been doing all these really low IBU beers, which is they're good in their own right, but dank they are not. And I bought this excited to have a dank double IPA, and in that regard, I was disappointed. If they had said it's a full-bodied, smooth double IPA, I would have been like, oh, wow, that sounds interesting. This is really good. This does that. But it doesn't. It's not dank. So it's a false promise on the back of the can. it's a good beer that was not as advertised and wasn't what I was expecting. So I have to give it a little knock for that. But if you know what it is going into it, you won't be disappointed because it genuinely is a good beer. It's just not what they say it is.
Okay. Well, I'll have to look for that around here because we are getting a number of 6-point beers around here, but it's not something I remember seeing, though.
It's fairly new. I believe it is. It wasn't like one of the single-day releases I go to the brewery for.
Yeah.
But I've only seen it in the store a handful of times, so I believe it's not as wide release as some of the other stuff, but I believe it's just a newer one, so hopefully you'll see it soon.
Yeah, because I can find like the resin stuff here, you know, no problem now. So, yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Do you guys get Bengali?
I believe so.
Bengali is a nice, smooth, rich IPA. It's nothing crazy, but it's good.
Mm-hmm. Well, with that, so Diami, where can folks find you on the interwebs?
People can find me on Twitter at Diami Plotke and on Instagram at Penultimate Woodshop. And on Untapped at Penultimate Beer. And you?
Wow. Well, you can always find me on Instagram. Instagram, the only. And Sean, where can folks find you?
I'm at SeanW78 on most social medias, including Untapped and Instagram. So there.
Wow.
Consistency. sorry, and with that just about wraps up our show. If you haven't already, please subscribe to the show on any podcatcher of your choice, including iHeartRadio, which isn't really a podcatcher, but just listen to us there.
Absolutely. And you can follow us on Twitter at @MWA_national, on Instagram at @MWA_podcast. And I think you should go into your workshop and take a man-made material and glue a couple pieces up and make something interesting. Just remember that while MDF and timber strand and plywood cut with the same tools you'd use on other things, masonry doesn't.